I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we're going to spend some time talking about the power of social media. In a few minutes, we'll meet one of Bahrain's most popular bloggers. He's actually been in hiding for the past 2 years to avoid arrest for his critiques of his government. He's now been granted political asylum in London, and he'll share some of his thoughts with us in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about how social media can spread all kinds of messages. Recently, we've talked a lot about Twitter, for example, how it played a role in building up a fan base for the ABC hit Scandal. But Twitter can also be a vehicle for some really raw, offensive messages. Racist, homophobic, you name it. Our next guests have tried to see if there's actually a pattern to this. Monica Stevens is an assistant professor of geography at Humboldt State University. That's in Arcata, California. From June of 2012 to April 2013, she sorted through hate speech on Twitter and quite literally put it on a map. The map is called The Geography of Hate, and it's been published on the blog floatingsheep.org. And Professor Monica Stevens is with us now. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. Also with us is Danielle Belton. She is editor-at-large for Clutch Magazine Online and creator of theblacksnob.com. She's a regular contributor to our program and is very active on social media, and she's with us now as well. Danielle, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be here.
So, Professor Stevens, let's start with you. Let's just say the methodology is very interesting, but I don't want to spend all of our time on it. But just briefly, because you do go into detail about this on the blog, so if people are really interested, they can read all about it. But just briefly, your team pulled together every geocoded tweet in the U.S. from June 2012 to April 2013 that contained certain keywords related to hate speech, like the N-word or the F-word and people and so forth like that. So why don't you pick up the thread there?
Yeah, and then my students actually read through every single geocoded tweet using one of these words to determine if the sentiment in the tweet was negatively aimed towards that particular group or positively aimed towards that group or neutral towards that group. So they were able to determine when these terms were used in jest or when they were joking or when someone was actually using the term to say, hey, I'm really offended when you use that term.
Mm-hmm. And by geocoded, that means what?
Sure. So geocoding is simply the process of adding an X and a Y coordinate to the tweet itself. So it locates where that tweet is in material space. So we could actually look at it and zoom in if I had allowed that on the map. And you could actually see even sometimes what part of the house somebody is in and what they're. But for this map, I aggregated it all to the county level and then normalized that by the total amount of tweets that were in that county over the same time period.
And what was the point of doing that?
That was first to protect the privacy of the people who were tweeting. And the other purpose was to account for population density. As you know, some areas use Twitter more than other areas. There are obviously more tweets sent out from Los Angeles than there are from Omaha, Nebraska. And so just to account for that sort of difference to say, okay, well, even if Los Angeles has the largest number of purely hateful tweets, we didn't want it to look like it's the hot spot on the map.
So we can go through all the qualifiers that the attitudes captured are people who use Twitter and are geotagging and using certain terms. But even having said all that, just give us the headline as you saw it.
Well, one of the things that was most interesting was the term that it was used to refer to people who are perhaps illegal immigrants. And that ended up being very much clustered in Texas around San Antonio and the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So when you start to see that sort of clustering happen, that people in that area are more likely to use that term in a negative way, it starts to give us an idea of how conversations are happening within the country.
And the N-word was ever popular, correct?
Yes.
I mean, that of
yes.
all of the terms that seem to surface the most often, the N-word seemed, from my reading of the map, seemed to continue to be everlasting, right?
Yeah, those students went through about 90,000 uses of the N-word to determine which ones were negative.
And geographically, did you notice, was there any trend that was significant?
It tends to be in smaller towns, particularly in the Midwest, sort of the Rust Belt area, more so than it is in the South, but it's also quite present within Georgia and Alabama as well.
So, Danielle, as somebody who's connected through blogging, you kind of live on Twitter, right, and in social media, what do you make of this? Surprising? Not surprising?
It's not surprising. I mean, one of the things that attracts people to Twitter is the fact that it can be an anonymous forum. So people can rant and vent and say things that they would never say to your face online. It's an app tool for what many people call trolling. So it's a way to get people incensed, a way to get a whole lot of attention. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you would find in small towns, that you'd have someone who's already anonymous because of the power of Twitter, would feel like they're free, you know, to speak their mind, and their mind might possibly be filled with hate.
Professor Stevens, I know that just in the map is interactive. I mean, you can pick certain terms and see where there were clusters of those terms, noting, as you said, that certain terms for people of Mexican descent, right, that have been used in the past, like the W word, let's call it that, seem to be located in certain areas. Even with all that, were you surprised that the West Coast did not show a lot of these terms?
Yeah, I was surprised, but what I was more surprised by was that these terms are happening everywhere, that especially the N-word is quite universal around the United States. It wasn't just in small towns in the South, which is what, you know, we would have initially assumed.
What else? Were there any places where you didn't find that those terms being used?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I've gotten a lot of people questioning, well, you know, why is it that Illinois or Indiana looks more hateful than Montana? And part of it is that there's just not as many people on Twitter altogether in Montana.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new study that literally puts certain racist, homophobic, and hate speech directed toward people with disabilities on the map. Our guest is Professor Monica Stevens, who led a team that literally put these terms on a map. Danielle, you wanted to say something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say that it doesn't surprise me that you'd have a lot of racist tweets out of Illinois or Indiana. Being a native Midwesterner, there are certain regions and hotspots within these individual states that have a reputation for people being very vocal about minorities. And in the case of Illinois and Indiana and even my home state of Missouri, you have a significant African-American population, not enough where we're the majority in any type of capacity, but just enough where people feel the need that they can be very expressive in how they want to complain about it. Well, you know, you can't complain about something unless you actually see it on a daily basis. So it's like, I think maybe people use Twitter less in Montana, but there's also a lot fewer minorities in Montana.
Well, but that's an interesting question, though, because there's all kinds of conventional wisdom, which may or may not comport with fact, around how racial attitudes are formed. But one of the sort of the truisms is that familiarity would lessen these kinds of attitudes because people would know somebody. Right. They would know somebody of a different race and therefore they or hopefully more than one person. And therefore that there would be less inclination toward these kinds of attitudes.
That's true. But in the Midwest, a lot of these major cities are heavily segregated. So in many cases, familiarity has bred like contempt between people because people are in their segregative enclaves and they feel very strongly by people who are different from them.
Professor Stevens?
I think that it's also that they haven't been together. I think that people are more likely to tweet something using the N-word, for example, if they have had a negative experience with somebody who's Black. And you'll notice that where I live in Arcata, California, there's very little traffic. And part of it is there's very little Twitter traffic, but also there aren't that many Black people, but also people do live in less segregated ways than they do in some cities where you have a Black area of a city and a white area of a city and perhaps an Asian area of a city.
Again, I said I didn't want to get stuck on the methodology, but Professor Stevens, I did find the methodology fascinating in the sense that there were so many uses of the B word that you didn't have the research funding to pay people to go through all of them to determine whether they were positive or negative. There were literally millions. And I'm wondering if you have any hypothesis about that. Why is the use of the B word so prevalent?
There were 5.5 million geocoded tweets using the B word over this 10-month period. And so to pay students to read every single one would have been about 641 days of student work in order to do that. So it wasn't feasible to look through it. But why do I think people use it more? I think it's often more used in also a positive, in a jeering way. Somebody pointed out that dog breeders use the word as well. So I think that it's used in a variety of different contexts.
And tell us, if you would, about the responses that you've been getting to your study.
Well, I've received a lot of comments from people who haven't been able to read the frequently asked questions part on our blog, floatingsheep.org. And so that's where I've been able to refer most people to as we address issues where people comment and say, oh, it's not normalized by population. It's like, yeah, it is. California has 1/8 of the population of the United States, and it hardly shows up in the map. So that's one response I've gotten. I've also received a large response from white men who feel that they're being discriminated at by not being included in the map. And we actually tried to. We also looked at words like honky, cracker, and gringo, but actually those weren't necessarily used in a negative way very often, particularly the word honky, which often is referring to honky-tonk music and honky-tonk bars, and people were using it in a very, very positive context. So it wasn't something that we could include in the map because it ends up being very, just such a small number of words that are actually negative.
Redneck?
Redneck had a huge number as well, but a lot of them weren't really negative towards rednecks. And they were also generally leveraged by people of the same group. And so, you could kind of tell that.
So it's being familial in the same way that familial. Some black people use the N-word in a familial way, which you also screened out. For as not being negative. I understand that you kind of want to stick to the research, but any particular conclusion you'd want to point us to about this?
At this point, we're still examining a lot of the conclusions as far as the underlying demographics of this, but I think one of the things that pops out is the small town nature, and perhaps these are places that have experienced larger amounts of job loss over recent years, so that's an avenue I want to explore further.
Danielle, what about you? Any conclusions that you would point us to?
I would say that this is just another example about how far we have to go as a society when it comes to race and ethnicity. Even though she couldn't normalize it for gender, because the fact the term is used so much, the fact that the B word is a normal term for a lot of people to throw around, even though it has a negative connotation, is indicative of how far we still have to go.
Danielle Belton is editor-at-large for Clutch Magazine Online and creator of theblacksnob.com. She was with us from St. Louis, Missouri. Monica Stevens is assistant professor of geography at Humboldt State University, although we caught up with her in Lexington, Kentucky, where she's traveling. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
Massive open online courses, or MOOCs, are reshaping the landscape of higher education. And there's no bigger MOOC than Coursera, the for-profit tech company with 3.5 million people taking its online courses. Today, Coursera unveiled a partnership with 10 state university systems, serving well over a million students. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, it is the biggest shift so far of degree-granting institutions into the world of global online education.
For Tennessee's 46 public colleges and universities, the deal with Coursera is huge, but not without its risks.
This is a leap in faith, but again, I think the potential good far outweighs the bad.
Rich Rota is executive director of Tennessee's Higher Education Commission. He says the bad is not knowing whether MOOCs can truly complement, let alone replace, traditional classroom instruction.
Well, you just described the discussions in Tennessee. We look at it as an experiment.
The good that could result from this experiment, says Rota, is that students may now be able to earn a degree more quickly, more cheaply, entirely online, or as part of a regular course. Institutions will be able to showcase their top professors and connect students to professors at other schools. As part of the Coursera network, the University of Tennessee system and those in New York, Georgia, Colorado, Kentucky, Nebraska, New Mexico, West Virginia, and the Houston University system will now join the ranks of elite institutions that have embraced the MOOC model. Like most states involved in the deal, colleges in Tennessee already offer lots of courses online, which Coursera will format into modules for a fee.
We're talking about $3,000 to $5,000.
That's per course. It's a fraction of what it costs to develop and deliver a regular course. That's the hook, says Rota.
Replacing campus scholars with cyber scholars.
Schools save money and cut costs. It's how schools are responding to tight budgets and the economic realities of higher education.
This is going to transform the way that we teach on college campuses. It's not going to substitute for it.
Daphne Kohler is Coursera's co-founder, a professor of computer science at Stanford University, who, by the way, hates the term MOOCs, but who's pushing the concept and turning higher education on its head.
The whole landscape of higher education has been reshaped as a consequence of this phenomenon. Multiple institutions that had never really considered online to be a critical part of their mission are now no longer thinking whether, they're thinking when and how.
Still, even among institutions that are partnering with Coursera, there are questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Houston Davis is chief academic officer and vice chancellor with the University System of Georgia.
I don't think anyone should see it as a magic pill. This has to be about high-quality teaching and learning opportunities at an affordable price for students.
This fall, Davis says Georgia's 31 state colleges and universities will be working with Coursera to improve quality, access, and raise college completion rates. Critics aren't so sure, though, that Coursera or MOOCs in general can do any of these things.
Whether it costs a little less or a little more, I would not want my child's education to be an experiment.
Eileen Landy, professor of sociology at the State University of New York, Old Westbury, is with a union that represents the 35,000 faculty members in the SUNY system.
We know MOOCs have about an average 10% completion rate, and that's among very highly motivated students. If you target MOOCs for incoming students, students who need remediation, the chances are we'll lose them.
But Nancy Zimfer, the chancellor of the SUNY system, says that with nearly 500,000 students on 64 campuses, SUNY's goal is to use Coursera to help more students complete their degrees, not discourage them.
And since we have so many people who need what we offer, why not enhance access and completion through this vehicle as well?
It's the future, says Zimfer. As for Coursera's future, Daphne Kohler says its partnership with states will be a model for working with countries around the world where people have no access to higher education.
You can basically change lives by giving people an opportunity that they never had before.
Kohler calls it Coursera's social mission. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
This is NPR.
When a country's economic growth improves, that would seem to be all good. It certainly has the potential for changing the way a country is viewed by the world. And that can happen when the government changes the way it calculates the gross domestic product, or GDP. Marianne McCune of Planet Money and WNYC brings us the story of a few countries in Africa doing just that.
Best case scenario, this GDP trick will help people like these two guys, Bayo Puricombe and Zubair Abubakar. To get better phone reception, they're standing on the roof of the office where they invent cool applications for Nigeria's low-tech cell phones. This one is a game where players pretend to drive the notoriously wild buses that these two can see from where they're standing.
Yeah, because the drivers are aggressive, they drive rough. And they can be very unfriendly.
The goal is to pick up as many passengers as you can while weaving through traffic and evading cops. These guys think they can make a lot of money for some savvy foreign investors. But one of the many challenges they face, on paper, Nigeria's economy doesn't look as dazzling as it could. For more than two decades, Nigeria has been estimating its gross domestic product, basically the value of everything the country produces, using data collected in 1990. And a lot has changed since then. Like, just for example, now people have cell phones. So Nigeria plans to update its GDP. It's called rebasing. They'll use data from a more recent and more relevant year. And this could make Nigeria's economy number one in sub-Saharan Africa, surpassing South Africa.
Absolutely.
Across the Atlantic, emerging markets analyst Sebastian Spio Garbrandt says that new number could do a lot for Abubakar and Puricombe. Picture a Silicon Valley firm looking to invest in a foreign video game startup.
All of a sudden, when they go to their board meeting and they are looking at the top 10 economies in the world, Nigeria will be up there with Brazil, India, and China. It puts them in the big league.
The funny thing is, all that potential movement of capital, if it happens, it will all be based on a new number, not a new reality. So I have a sort of silly question. Aren't international investors smarter than that? I mean, don't they recognize that this is just a number that's changed, not any reality on the ground?
No, they are not. No, they are not.
Investors are busy, he says, and they need numbers to compare one country to another. Sebastian Spio Garbrandt is originally from Ghana, three countries to the west of Nigeria. And when Ghana updated its GDP in 2010, in one single day, it moved from low income to middle income in the eyes of the world. And soon after, Spio Garbrandt says, the government was able to start borrowing a lot more foreign money at low cost by selling bonds. But there's a flip side. With its higher GDP, Ghana can no longer get the international aid reserved for low-income countries.
People at the bottom of society who actually need health care and education and other things which foreign aid often supports and become even more vulnerable.
Basically, a lot depends on what you do with the investment you attract, says economist John Page of the Brookings Institution. If Ghana borrows a bunch of money to build a string of gold-plated palaces, not so helpful. But if, after Nigeria updates its GDP, foreign investors fly to Lagos to meet up with those guys making cell phone games?
That's one of the really good examples of where this can have a positive impact. I certainly would prefer that some of my nearest and dearest didn't spend as much time on video games as they do.
Well, they also did a whole app that allows you to carry the Nigerian constitution in your phone and access it.
There we go. So, you know, this is a terrifically good example of how this can really be of help.
What you want is for your higher GDP to lead to more jobs and less poverty. The problem is it often doesn't. Some of the fastest growing economies in Africa are creating very few jobs. Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In 2011, a group of researchers in Japan made a surprising discovery. With the right process, they could turn cement, in fact, a component of the Portland cement you can find in the hardware store, they can turn that into a metal. And in its metallic state, they could coax the cement to act as a semiconductor. Now researchers report on why it can happen, work that could help fine-tune the process and make semiconducting cement more widespread. Think light, cheap electrodes, battery components, a concrete computer screen. Well, ask the scientists involved. Chris Benmore is a physicist in the X-ray Science Division at Argonne National Laboratory in Argonne, Illinois. He's one of the authors of a paper on the research published this week in the proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
When you say, do you really mean that the cement like we can buy in a bag at the lumberyard?
Right. A component of that cement, one called mayonite, yes, they've managed to treat that in such a way that you can turn it from an insulator into a metal. And what we've done is we've used very powerful experimental and theoretical probes to explain why that happens. And so this opens up a whole new area for designing new materials.
When you say turning it into a metal, this is something that was discovered, as I said, a few years ago. Does it harden into concrete like cement does when it's finished?
It turns a different color. It's actually a glass. So it's basically a liquid that's quenched to form a solid glass. Not unlike the one you would drink out of, but it's actually black. And it has very different properties once it's in that state to what it would normally have. It basically in the bag at the hardware store.
So once it's in this glass form, it becomes a metal, a semiconductor, like transistor material, stuff like
right,
that.
The conductivity increases massively, and it acts as if it were a metal. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you have discovered why that happens.
Yes, what we've done, the initial discovery was by the Japanese, and they have lots of applications for it already. But what we've managed to do is figure out how it happens and why it works. So we've used very powerful X-rays to look into where the atoms are and how they're arranged and how they can trap the electrons to make this massive conductivity change.
So they have to make electricity is the flow of electrons. So you have to find a way of having excess electrons to flow around, and you trap them there. And that's how you made it. Cement into a metal.
That's right. It's the cement is actually reduced with titanium, and so it takes the electrons from that. But the actual structure traps those electrons, and they're sort of free electrons, and they create that's where the conductivity comes from. The trick, as it turns out, is how this structure arranges, how the different atoms in the cement arrange themselves, and the charges they take to actually trap those free electrons and increase the conductivity.
So you could turn then cement into sort of semiconductor electronic parts.
That's right. It's been proposed that you could use this technology for tunable lightweight metal oxides or electrodes for fuel cells or mainly actually for flat panel displays. Because it's a glass, you could make a big glass sheet of it.
Wow. And I'll bet you, since it's an abundant item, right, you can buy it in a hardware store.
Yes, it's basically in slag. It's basically very, very common material, a calcium aluminate that's called mayonite that you can that's very readily available, so very cheap.
So you can engineer it and design it into almost any shape, size, form you want to then?
You have to heat it up pretty high to make it liquid, but it's, since it's a glass, you can mold it into various different forms. That's right. So it's very versatile in that way.
This explanation of how it works, does this offer you and other scientists an opportunity to study other materials or find out other ways things might work and become semiconductors?
Absolutely. I think the reason we were able to figure it out was because we have these very powerful probes, like this very high energy, very powerful X-ray source, and these supercomputers where we're able to look at the atomic level of how the atoms are arranged, and when they're arranged in a certain way, why they exhibit this behavior. And we can try and reproduce that in other materials, or maybe even enhance it and design from the bottom up new types of materials that have very strange properties.
Huh. And I think it's quite fascinating, the tools that you use. One of the tools you use was an aerodynamic levitation furnace. Sounds like out of a science fiction movie.
It sort of is magical. It's basically a gas jet, like you might have a hairdryer and you can float a ping pong ball on it. I think we've all done that as kids. And in that same way, we can basically float a little chunk of cement and we can fire a laser at it to melt it. And in that way, when it cools from the melt, it will glass. It won't hit a surface and crystallize. So it's a part of the way of getting a pristine sample that we could do our experiments on without any contamination to make this material.
If it forms in, you know, my chemical engineering, my civil engineering purists always say, you're confusing cement with concrete. They do different things. When it solidifies, is it a concrete or is it a glass or somewhere in between?
It's a glass. Well, concrete itself or even cement are both very complicated hydrates. This is just one component of the cement, calcium aluminate. And when you actually quench it, it forms a pretty hard glass. It does have voids in it. In fact, that's part of the structure that allows it to conduct the way it is. But it's basically, for all intents and purposes, like a solid piece of glass.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go now with your work? What how do you move this on further?
Right. Well, we think we can probably find this phenomenon in lots of other materials that could exhibit the same behavior if we arrange them in the same way. So we're in the sort of stage of saying, well, what else can this happen in? Can we enhance this effect? Can we make it better? Or could we find even other effects that could have maybe slightly different properties that we could tune for other applications?
Using the same cement or looking through other materials?
Looking at other materials, looking at different atoms within the cement, the ones that actually caused the phenomenon, looking at those and seeing if there are other ones, whether it's a widespread phenomenon or whether it's just associated with those ones in particular. That's quite an important thing to see how it can be exploited for future applications.
You've got to be working on some other stuff, some other materials right now.
Oh, we're always working on lots of other materials. That's right. I mean, we work on everything from cement to spider silks to battery research. So we have an array of ideas and things going on at the lab.
Yeah, you guys at Argonne are always very busy.
That's true.
Well, and then thank you very much for taking a little bit of time to talk with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Chris Benmore is a physicist in the X-ray Science Division. That's at the Argonne National Laboratory in Argonne, Illinois.
Does your local high school have a student newspaper? And in this day, when a social media message saying, "Tonight's green design and technology class homework sucks," can instantly be sent to thousands, does it need to? The New York Times reports this week that only 1 in 8 of New York's public high schools has a student newspaper. Many of those are just published a few times a year. A few more are online, which can leave out poorer schools. The national figures are a little higher, but as Rebecca Dwarka, an 18-year-old senior in the Bronx who works for her student paper, the DeWitt Clinton News, told the Times, Facebook is the new way of finding out what happened. Nobody wants to actually sit down and read a whole article about it, which does make a whole article sound a little like a long sentence in solitary confinement. Now, I'm not nostalgic about high school student newspapers and never worked for mine. I put out what was then called an underground magazine with a group of friends because we wanted to write about peace, war, and rock and roll without school officials admonishing us not to make jokes about the local alderman. But we learned. Trying to convince a local druggist to buy an ad in your slender rag can be humbling and make you determined to turn out a paper he's proud to have his name in, too. Hearing that school newspapers are in decline because students now find out what happened in social media bites is a little discouraging because it confirms that for millions of Americans, journalism is becoming a do-it-yourself enterprise. When a tornado strikes or a bomb goes off, we look for social media messages as soon as they flash, too. Facebook posts and tweets have become the means by which politicians, celebrities, citizens, and reporters, for that matter, can confirm, deny, pass on stories, and register opinion without the press challenging, probing, presupposing, slowing, or straining the message. That's just how we talk to each other in these times. Matt Drudge, who runs his own controversial website, says, "We have entered an era vibrating with the din of small voices. Every citizen can be a reporter." But truly good journalism is a craft, not just a blog post. It requires not only seeing something close up, but reporting it with perspective. It uses an eye for detail to help illuminate a larger view. And even journalism that conveys an opinion strives to be fair. If school newspapers begin to disappear, I hope there are other ways for students to learn that. Who wants yesterday's papers? Who wants yesterday's gun? The Stones, and you're listening to NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and this week we begin a new series from the NPR Cities Project.
Develop it into a world-class city.
If other cities can do it, we can do it.
This whole building is based on technology.
Second floor, technology.
We're reporting on urban innovation in the 21st century, how cities are striving to use technology to become more efficient, more coordinated in all manners of ways. And today, we go to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro is standing by. Hello, Lulu.
Hello.
And tell us about the challenges facing Rio.
This is a city with a whole host of issues. It's a tourist hub. Only in the next few months there will be two mega events, the visit of Pope Francis and the soccer tournament, the Confederations Cup. In the next few years it will be hosting the World Cup and the Olympics. Add to that the millions of residents who live here from all social classes, from the shanty towns perched on the cliffs above me to the glittering apartment blocks by the beach, and you have a vibrant but a really difficult city to manage.
And how has Rio done that in the digital age?
Well, picture mission control at NASA and how it ran nearly every aspect of the flight of a space shuttle, for example. Now, imagine applying that logic to running a city. You've just really envisioned the operations center here in the city of Rio. I'm standing outside it right now, and earlier I got a chance to meet the director of this ambitious operation.
My name is Pedro Junqueira. I'm the chief executive officer of the Centro de Operações Rio.
We are standing in front of a huge bank of screens, in the middle of which is a glowing map that changes focus depending on what the dozens of white jumpsuited controllers are looking at. This is Rio in real time.
This whole building is based on technology. and integration.
The brainchild of the city mayor, Junqueira, says the Rio Operations Center is unique, custom-built by IBM to act as a kind of master control for the city. The workers here are getting live streaming data from the ground and the sky.
We have here almost 600 cameras, people looking at the radar, at satellites, and seeing if it's going to rain or heavy or not.
Rain is a particular concern in Rio, where shanty towns are built into the hills. In fact, a few years ago, one deadly storm inspired the mayor to commission the operation center. Now, in the most vulnerable areas, alarms sound telling people when they have to evacuate, and it's all managed from here.
We get to know what's happening faster, and we can put our teams on the street to respond faster.
Junqueira says it's not just the technology. What is really revolutionary is having a single place where over 30 agencies work together. Before, he explains, if there was a crisis, the only way to get everyone notified was to work the phones. But now, he says, it's pretty seamless.
We have the police, we have the traffic engineer, we have an agency that knows everything about mountains in this area. We have the gas company, the light company, all of them together here. If I pick up the microphone and pronounce once what's happening, all of them, they know.
And they can see it. On the screens, there are images of traffic-clogged streets, construction sites, the subway system, anything that may cause a potential problem. Another one of the key components is the media. There is a group assigned to covering social media sites to see what's going on in the city. But more traditional networks have a dedicated space here, too, in a press box perched right above the main floor. And it's made the city operations more accountable, transparent, and effective, say journalists. Alexandre Alves works for Radio Odia. Before, we used to have to get information from Twitter, for example, and now at the operations center, you can see the situation firsthand, see the cause, how many people are affected, what hospital they're being taken to, all this in one place in a more accurate way, he says. What that means is that the wider public is also being better informed. They'll know, for example, what roads have been closed due to an accident, and they can avoid that stretch, making it easier for rescue workers to do their jobs. Junqueira says the operations center has become vital to the way the city is now managed.
Imagine World Cup, the Pope's event in the middle of the year, the Olympic Games 2016. Sometimes I think it would be impossible to run the city as big as Rio, with so many things changing, without a place like this.
It's pretty quiet here inside the operations center, so it's hard to get a sense of just how complicated and vast the city really is. To do that, you have to step outside, as I'm doing now, and go to the scene of a recent disaster on the streets of Rio.
I was inside the building when I saw some stonework falling. I ran away. There was a lot of dust. A friend of mine died there. He was running out of the building like me, but suddenly remembered his wife was still inside, and he went back to save her, and the two died.
Vicente Antonio da Cruz is a street vendor just outside a building in downtown Rio that collapsed recently. It was the first real test of the operations center. Along with Da Silva's friends, another 15 people died in the accident. But it could have been much worse, say city officials. The system inside the center works on a series of alerts. A green light says everything is running normally. On that day, the light was flashing red, meaning it was all hands on deck. When they found out what had happened, the center immediately coordinated the closure of streets, the evacuation of the wounded to the area's hospitals, the deployment of rescue workers. Luis Antonio Coelho operates a newsstand nearby the collapsed building. He says the city's response was good. It was very fast, he says. Help came very soon. Within 10 to 15 minutes, the area was blocked off, he says. But when I ask him about the operations center, he shrugs and says he's never heard of it. That's one of the strange things about the use of technology in cities. Most people aren't really aware of it. A lot of the people that I've spoken to here don't even know what the center of operations is or what it does, but they felt the effects of it in small and big ways, as we saw when this building collapsed here. This is Lourdes Garcia Navarro on the Avenida 13 de Mayo in Rio de Janeiro.